Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Quote, trying innovative things just keeps me on my toes, and that piece of teaching really energizes me. I think the innovation comes from keeping up with what's happening in the world, what's happening in the art world, and wanting to learn something alongside my students. So observed my guest today, Dr. Colleen Stockman of the Gustavus Art and Art History Department, in response to winning one of the college's innovative teaching awards in spring 2022. A graduate of McAllister College with a BA in Studio Arts, Dr. Stockman earned her PhD in Art History from the University of Minnesota in 2020 and joined the Gustavus faculty that same year. Her courses include both halves of the Art History Survey, Critical Issues in Art, Gender in Art, Visual Information, Contemporary Art, and Art History, Theory and Methods. In addition to teaching, she researches craft and artistic processes and the histories of pigments and dyes in the Atlantic world. Related, she co-leads a research workshop on global histories of color in the pre- and early modern world and is interested in, quote, enslavement in the Atlantic world and its tethers to visual culture and ways of making. Professor Stockman is the recipient of various grants and fellowships, including an Emerging Arts Professionals Fellowship and a short-term fellowship at the Huntington Library's Art Museum in San Marino, California. She's published articles in the journals American Craft Inquiry and Dilettante and curated at the San Francisco Center for the Book, the city's contemporary Jewish Museum, and the Cantor Arts Center at Stanford University. Currently, she's leading students in an objects audit for the Gustavus Archival and Museum Collections as part of the college's Indigenous Reconciliation Initiatives. An artist herself, she also draws. As someone long interested in art history and more recently visual culture as part of my courses on slavery and freedom in the Atlantic world and the U.S. Civil War, I've been keen to speak with Dr. Stockman about her teaching, research, and path to both, and I'm delighted she could join me for this conversation. So welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus. Colleen, it's great to have you on.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be chatting with you. Thank you.
Yeah, and I know you've, as we do, I sometimes say to people, you know, when they ask me, what do? I say, we get paid to rush. So I know you're rushing from a meeting to this conversation, this recording. So thanks so much for doing that late in the day here. Let's start with you. Since I'm the historian, I love doing that. I'm also just curious about people. I'll start with your own background. Where'd you grow up? Are you a Minnesotan? I sort of assume that since you went to Mac, but Mac draws from all over the country, I know.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I'm actually from outside of Chicago in Oak Park.
Oh, you're like me. Did we talk about that already? That one time we met, my God. You said Oak Park, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where my Greek grandfather had a barbershop for a long time, right at the right at the Marion Street L. Yeah, I grew up. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. My dad grew up in the city. Anyway, so Oak Park. Wow. Yeah, what part of Oak Park?
Oak Park and Division. So the north. What is that? The north side.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
It's small.
Know it well. Yeah, and some people may know. Some listeners may know Oak Park because of some of the Frank Lloyd Wright housing. That's cool. So that's where you grew up. What were your parents from there? From the city or?
My parents are both from Chicago. Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so they were nearby. I guess she did grow up a little bit in Oak Park too. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. We have a Chicago contingent because Rachel McCarthy, do you know Rachel? I'm just getting to know her. She's helping with the podcast now. She's a Chicagoan also.
Ah.
I haven't met her yet. So three of us have to get together. Anyway, three cheers for Chicago. So you grew up there. Were you already doing art as a kid? I mean, aside from, you know, the usual, I don't know, we all make some kind of stuff with our fingers and paints. But when did the interest in art or in art history develop?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say I was always doing art. Yeah, I remember my mom loves to talk about like when I was little starting to draw people, I was very interested in like the direction of the eyes and like the eyelashes. And they saved all my art from kidhood. So yeah, definitely like, you know, tinkering with things and, you know, building stuff and drawing and painting. Those are things I did from a young age.
Were you going, I assume, like to the Art Institute and I don't know, are the other museums as well?
Yeah, the Art Institute. And then I don't know when the Museum of Contemporary Art opened, but definitely spent a lot of time there.
I was just thinking about that. I can't remember either. I've been there, both my wife, Kate, and I, more than once. My dad always said, he's now deceased, both parents, but I don't even know if this is true, but he painted like crazy. He did a lot of painting. And he said he studied for a time at the Art Institute. He didn't go to college, but he painted and did, I guess, mostly painting, some drawing. So our house was filled with art. My dad's art primarily that he would
awesome. And
frame wet, you know, but in any case, he took us to the Art Institute often, my brother and me, and I'm so grateful for that. I still love that.
Yeah. It's a special museum for sure. And just the nostalgia of walking through those different areas and seeing that George O'Keefe and that stairwell, you know, it's one of the only things that's still there from the previous modern wing now that they've built the new.
Yeah. The new wing. I mean, I was impressed with it. Mm-hmm. Do boys go through? I wasn't dinosaurs. It was maybe because I was past my dinosaur phase if I ever had one. But it was in high school and then in college, you know, impressionists. So going to the impressionist collection there was just so much fun. Great museum. Did you take courses there at all too? Or?
No, I did some cool like art courses at different places in the city, like Anchor Graphics. It's not there anymore, but I think they got absorbed by Columbia College. It was this awesome printmaking studio that had, I want to say they were free, but I'm not sure, printmaking classes for high schoolers. So yeah. I would take the L down with a couple of friends on Saturdays. And it was just like three of us from the suburb, from Oak Park, and everybody else was from like the city arts high school and stuff. But yeah, that was a pretty wonderful formative place.
That sounds fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about in school itself? Did they have, I mean, I had, I'm trying to think, we didn't have art history in high school. It was certainly art, but I mean, with all the cutbacks we hear about, were you able to take art courses in grade school and or high school?
Yeah, I had some great art courses. And like, I remember seventh or eighth grade, Mr. Brown, I don't know what his first name was, but it was like me and my friend Jane Ryder, who's still very much an active artist. And we somehow got to do like an independent study or something, you know, it's like big public school, junior high. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how we managed that, but it was amazing just to get to actually, you know, have a quiet time in junior high when it's so chaotic, and B, just to get this sort of, you know, one-on-one lessons almost about paint and painting and canvas and color and
That's fantastic.
We had great classes at my high school too. Also just, you know, OPRF, the big public high school, but there was a great photography program. So there's like three different dark rooms and I did a lot of darkroom photography.
Oh, wow.
And there was a great ceramics class, drawing.
Oh, the whole deal. Wow. You're lucky. You may not remember, maybe do, were you doing like, oil paints or watercolors or everything?
Chalk. I mean, the junior high moment, like I had a little bit of paint and acrylic then, but I didn't really do much painting again until college.
Okay.
Now, I'm not as interested in painting in general, actually.
Okay.
So yeah, drawing and printmaking was always more my speed. Yeah.
That's cool. There's a friend in my wife Kate and I live in downtown at Grand Park here in Minneapolis. And there's a friend in the building who he and his wife are both doing printmaking and they showed us their in fact he said, what is the center up in Minneapolis? Not the loft.
High Point?
Might be that. Yeah. Anyways, teaching. It's really cool. I love looking at that stuff. Oh, come to my office. You can see what he did. It's an American flag in a bell jar curled up inside. That's his latest. Anyway,
excellent.
It's really, yeah, that's what I think. Excellent. So were you, did I have an art history? I don't think I had art history per se in high school, but I had one teacher in particular with whom I podcast with, who grew up in Stan Moore, or Mr. Moore, as some people still call him, who, boy, he worked art into everything in his courses on Western Civ and the then Soviet Union. But when did you get the art history bug? How did that come about? Was that McAllister or before McAllister even?
Yeah, I think it was, maybe I didn't quite know that it was art history, but I did have this history teacher, Ms. Young, who was absolutely incredible. I almost said an expletive, but I have to remember being recorded.
And that's in high school?
Yeah. So And she taught world history and AP European history, and had the, well, just like she called us the people with golden hands. It's like the ones with golden hands could do, like, we had options with some of the different projects we could do, or when we were like designing t-shirts for the class or whatever. And then, but she did with the, she had these data, I don't know if this is a common thing, database question, DBQ. I don't know if she made that up or if that's like a pedagogical tool.
I don't know anything about it. Yeah.
Okay. So there'd be two, it was intense. Her classes were great and hard, but there'd be two giant stacks of primary sources for the exam time, for one of the types of exams. And one of them was textual and one of them was images.
Oh, wow.
So I would always choose the image-based ones. So we had clearly done some, you know, iconographical and more print, at least looking at like the history of print, since that was, you know, early modern Europe and stuff. So I think that was probably a big piece of it, right? Because then we had to read those images and demonstrate our understanding of whatever period of time we had just covered and what was happening socially, politically, economic, religious, military. Those were her kind of categories.
That's fantastic. So, I mean, you were doing, or she was doing visual culture, it sounds like, in a way. I mean, a bit of
Cool. And then we had like pretty significant research papers in that class too. And so I often was choosing some sort of visual culture. I did one on Wagner, I think, like music too. So So I think I got my taste of research and sort of primary source evidence back
That's
then.
Great. Yeah. Well, you're a historian. So did you, so at McAllister, you majored in studio arts, but is there art history there as well? You were studying, taking courses?
Yeah. It's such an interesting thing to think back on too, because there wasn't really art history at McAllister at the time. Don Sellender, who he taught there for many years. I should have looked him up before we are chatting here. But so he was the art historian when I started, and he passed away first year.
Oh.
So there was a gap in the department, and then they had a wonderful, amazing visiting professor, Chip Sheffield. So I took every class I could with him, and that was definitely a spark. But then there weren't any more. So the bulk of the art history was that the studio faculty, because it was a mixed department like it is here, studio and art history together. The studio faculty also always taught historical elements of whatever medium or whatever sort of topical thing they were doing. So like Chris Wilcox taught women in art, and Ruth Ann Godelli, who became my advisor and taught printmaking, she also would go into the whole history of the medium. And so I think just as a way of helping us understand the craft,
the history was built into that, into the courses that teaching. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh,
you're not allowed to take too many in one section. So I couldn't take enough to have double majored. It's basically not allowed because they insist that you're interdisciplinary.
I truly, and I said in the intro, and I really mean, I loved my art history. I mean, you're helping understand, but Stan Moore and some others that really, that was how I was getting art history. And you're right, I wouldn't have called it that at the time, and they weren't calling that. But then as an undergraduate at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, where I did my BA and then MA in history, both in history. But I, honest to God, I mean, there was something about the two art history professors. I know one was Mrs. Merritt, I'm pretty sure it was Mrs. I can picture her perfectly. I think the other one might have been Mr. Liakos. He was Greek like me. I'm real Greek. I'm Greek American, and I can still smell his cologne for sure. But they were fascinating. I just loved it. I loved it. And she would talk about one of the things I loved. I mean, she would talk about it, and you know, like going to galleries. Do you know what I mean? To look at stuff and on her own in New York or here. And I'd say, oh, this sounds so cool. But I did the visual. A few years ago, I took a seminar on the visual culture of the Civil War, and then one of these National Endowment for the Humanities things. I think it was that, something like that. In any case, and there was an art historian, I'm blanking on her name. I just loved her. Oh my gosh, she was fantastic too. And the whole point, what I learned, it was part of the institute or seminar, whatever the heck it was called. You know, we historians, we typically, you know, we tack on an image, right? To kind of, instead of what you just said a minute ago, instead of using the image as a text, but so one, a text itself. So one of the themes of this institute was, you know, how to make art historians and historians talk to, how to get them to talk to one another. How can historians, you know, use images, right? Not just paintings, as, you know, as text, not just as ancillary to what we're writing about a particular topic. I'm kind of going on, sorry. But anyway, it's
Yeah, it's such an important point. Yeah.
We can come back to that till we talk more about your other, your work. But so back up a bit. I want to back up. Why McAllister? What, because it's a, you know, another liberal arts college, a great liberal arts college. What led you there?
Yeah, well, I think in one of the other podcasts, I was learning maybe that, is it your wife went to Bard? So
she Bard went to Bard.
So I, why McAllister, it was a combination of things, but I realized that, cities are important to me. You know, I grew up in a city. I like being able to walk to everything I need.
Likewise.
I feel comfortable in a city. And I knew I wanted a small school. My high school had over, it was like almost 5,000 students. So pretty high school.
Wow.
easy to get lost. I mean, I did have incredible, you know, instruction and stuff, but it was also like a lot. So I thought, okay, I want to go somewhere smaller than that. And when you do the smaller than that and in a city, it narrows it down pretty fast. and I wanted somewhere that I could really design my own thing that didn't have a lot of requirements, that wasn't going to pin me down. I wanted to have options to study whatever I wanted to do.
Yeah. That's a cool thing about just what I know about McAllister's curriculum. I wish we had more. I mean, we have some of that at Gustavus, but I wish we had more. That's kind of what Kate had too. My wife, Kate, at Bard. And of course, Bard's, my God, art at Bard and as a whole. It's amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it was, when it came down to sort of the two of them, I just, obviously, you know, financial aid and that package was a piece of it. And then adding on the expense of like getting to and from, you know, middle of nowhere, New York back to Chicago. It's like, that's a cost too, you know?
Yeah. And so, probably, and even going from, you know, going from Bar to New York City, you know, from that's
right. I didn't have a car. And how was I going to do that? And then I was like, I think I'd feel isolated there. So the city.
I'm with you on that. That's why we eventually moved up to the Twin Cities after living in St. Peter for a while. The other thing is about, I mean, of course, God, the Twin Cities, I mean, the art scene here is pretty, well, you know more about it than I do, but seems like spectacular in all kinds, not just writing, but painting and poetry and every kind of printmaking and photography. What is the Center for Photography, whatever that's called in Northeast somewhere. So it's really cool. So it's not like you were in an art rich environment here.
Absolutely.
Without having to go to, you know, New York or New York City. So then at the University of Minnesota, that's really when you were able to focus on art history, it sounds like.
Yeah. So, and you know, there's a 10-year gap there between McAllister and University of Minnesota. So that, so it took a long time.
And that's when you're doing, the curating stuff. I mean, some of that stuff, I take it.
Which I guess is
art history too. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Absolutely. So I think part of the McAllister thing too is being in a city, being connected to places, starting to feel out what a career in the arts might look like, and just knowing I wanted to be, in that realm. So there's more options there than there are.
What took you out to California from Mac?
The real answer is fresh vegetables and queers. That's the line.
That's a perfectly fine answer. that's a very good answer. Those are two very good reasons. Yeah.
You want to elaborate
a little bit? Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. No, I mean, it's the easiest way. I had to come up with a way to distill it because people ask me it all the time. At that time I was like vegan and all these things, and I was like, it's so hard to get produce here. I mean, it's not anymore. You know, there's a million organic farms in Minnesota.
Yeah,
but
lucky.
So food, you know, food was important to me, and I was just like ready to be around more, you know, more people like me have that adventure. I also had the inkling that if I didn't leave the Midwest, then I might never, because Minneapolis is magical, because Chicago is a great city.
Right.
You know, the pull is real, and I love traveling. I've been all over, and So I thought, I should get out while I, you know, while I have the fire too. So.
Yeah, I think that's hugely important. And I actually wish, in my ideal world, everyone who goes to anywhere but goes to Gustavus, you would have to go elsewhere for at least, I don't know, a year, maybe 10 years, something to, before you can come back to wonderful Minnesota. But I love my brother, lives in Los Angeles. He's actually in the film business, but the technical side, lighting and all that, so film and TV. And now, so is his son. But I love it out there. We both do K9. Well, she doesn't like Los Angeles as much as I do, but of course, we love San Francisco. And she used to do a lot of research at the Huntington for her dissertation, which is such a beautiful. I've never been there.
Magical place to research.
Yeah, beautiful place.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I was there for a month in January.
Had you come out already to your family and stuff, or how did that? If I may ask.
Oh yeah, I mean. Yeah, I don't even remember all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I'm among the sort of more recent generations where like that was less of a thing for us than it was with previous, but definitely.
And I would imagine you found vegetables. You said vegetables and queer. Before we first moved to Minnesota, now you've got me on food. We first moved here, I was just pining for the kind of food scene we now have in the Twin Cities, which is one of the best in the country. It's really amazing. And I would think, you know, I could only get it in Chicago, New York, or, you know, Los Angeles or San Francisco. but now I don't, I love those places, but I don't feel like, oh my God, I'm missing out on the latest food or the coolest. There's so many great restaurants and chefs and organic and you name it, right? In the Twin Cities. It's really cool. Do you live up here, by the way? Do you live in the cities or where do you live?
I live in Minneapolis. And I'm don't tell everybody how good the food is. Like, we don't need this place overrun.
Yeah, I know. That's true.
I'm kidding. Good point. I'm kidding. No, there's enough for everybody.
So where are you living in Minneapolis?
I'm in South Minneapolis.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, 42nd Chicago.
Oh my God, go by there all the way. Geez, I used to hang out, the old Anodyne. And anyway, we can talk about that coffee shops. Yeah. We're downtown. We're right downtown at Grant Park, like, you know, Portland and 10th. And I really love the Twin Cities. Okay. So does Kate. They're really cool. When we first moved here, we were really oriented toward St. Paul more than Minneapolis because it reminded us of Boston, where we'd met at Boston University.
Oh, sure.
But yeah, we really, really, really like the Twin Cities. And we can talk about restaurants another time. So and that's an art, or the art of food.
Definitely. Yeah.
So I know I'm kind of, you know, one of the hard things for people on the podcast is I'm asking you to remember stuff, but your dissertation just sounds really, really interesting to me. And, you know, a lot of people would just, this who never speak about their dissertation again, but it sounded really, really interesting to me. I'm just going to read the title. This is at the University of Minnesota, Weeds and Wildflowers, Drawing, Landscape, and Abolition in New York, 1850 to 1870. How did you get into that? And there's just so much stuff. I just am fascinated by imagery or the iconography or the visual culture of abolitionism and slavery. But what led you into that topic?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those like dorky origin stories, but what better place for it, right? So I was working at Stanford and I was digging for, not digging, I was gently and carefully flipping through a box of prints and paintings for the Constable Cloud study. They had one Constable Cloud study. So I was putting that in a show called Conversation Pieces. So I was just pulling some of the things that, you know, I needed to confirm a couple of things, blah, blah, blah. And as I am, you know, things are organized in interesting ways in, you know, art storage. So you come across things that you, you know, aren't expecting.
Right.
And there was this giant set of graphite drawings that I couldn't tell if they were contemporary or, you know, historic, whatever. So I went back to the checklist and then I was like, oh, 1863. That's surprising to me. And just like they were these incredibly energetic drawings, and I just needed to know more about them, you know, as you could tell, I'm interested in drawing. So I went back to my desk, looked them up in the system, did a little bit of, you know, research, and I was like, huh, okay. So they were by this guy, William Trost Richards. And then I just got curious about what these were and, you know, given all the other things that were happening in the 1860s, why was this guy, you know, going to Atlantic City and making these sketches of weeds and wildflowers. So I was like, what, you know, what is this? So that was sort of the initial entree into it. And then it, you know, became a much bigger and more complicated thing once I found out a little bit more. So, but that initial impulse of what was happening during the 1860s and the iconography, the sort of classic things we know about visual representations of the events of the Civil War and of right. enslavement that led up to it. And then these, I was like, plants.
That's awesome. Okay.
So I wanted to get into what that was.
What's the abolitionist piece? Was he involved in that or?
Yeah. So he was a member of this group called the Society for the Advancement of Truth in Art. And it was a small collective of men mostly. And there were also women involved, but a small collective of folks who came together via their politics. They were anti-slavery, they were abolitionists, and they also wanted like reform in the art world. So reform writ large.
Yeah.
And they hated the status quo, and they hated, you know, what we now call the Hudson River School, large scale landscape painters. Yep. And they were really trying to get people to do something else, which was, among other things, drawing plants very carefully and methodically and meticulously as a means of better politics, they thought.
That is so fascinating. Oh my God. That's awesome. So we should do a whole podcast on that. Seriously. So then did you find letters and stuff for this group or, I mean, mm-hmm. you must've found writings. Yeah.
Yeah. Letters. I mean, it was a search cause this is like nothing quite like writing about a bunch of non-famous, you know, amateur people who didn't leave much of a paper trail, but a couple of them did. A couple of them became famous in other realms. Clarence King, who, you know, became geographer of the 44th parallel,
right, sure.
mapping out the West. And Russell Sturgis is an architect who has a bit of a trail. P.B. White was also involved. Chicago, you know, moved to Chicago in 1872, like many other architects, to rebuild after the fire. So some of the archives are at the Burnham Library there at the Art
Institute.
That is
so cool.
So there was like a little bit of a trail, but it was a lot of digging and, oh my God, the piles of letters at the New York Public Library. Just in like the uncatalogued section of, you know, the signature collection. No idea if a name that you needed was going to be there or not. And you had to decipher. Luckily it's all, you know, they're written in American English, but it's still a paleography of a certain sort.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. Oh my God. I tried reading Horace, the 19th century, you know, go West. You know, Horace Greeley's handwriting was notoriously difficult. Oh my God. I finally could read some of it after practicing it. Anyway, that is just so cool. We were talking beforehand, there's this new challenge curriculum at Gustavus and challenge seminar. And so the one I'm going to do is on dissent generally, but I'm going to focus it on abolitionism. So I'll be asking you to come in and help with the iconography. That's just so cool.
And the
connections. Thank you. The connections to politics, let's end slavery and reform art at the same time. Yeah, it sounds good. Mm-hmm. It's really amazing. I had not heard of that group at all until just now. So it's all new to me. Do you know why his drawings wound up where they did? It's Stanford. Do you have any idea of how they got there?
He made a ton of drawings, that guy Richards, and that was just a big, I'm like, do I have that catalog here? It was a donor. I can't remember, but I think it was just some, you know, it might have been a friend of a friend of the family. Someone did have quite a few of them in their collection, who had come from the East Coast but ended up on the West Coast, and that's why they ended up there. Yeah. But most of the rest of them are in East Coast.
In the East Coast. Okay.
Archives and museums.
Fantastic. Yeah. Wow. Wonderful. That's just cool. So are you still working on that? Are you trying to like get article or have you articles, other things out of the dissertation research?
Yeah. I mean, I'm working on the book version now, but the funny thing about it is that group has actually been sort of extracted in a way from the bulk of the research, I know it's like weeding out the,
it is.
So it's still related, but I really, the drawing component of the dissertation has sort of, you know, become a larger piece of it.
That's
so I'm looking
for the book. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm looking a lot at more vernacular drawing instructional texts, both in terms of popular magazines and of domestic publications and textbooks, both in botany and in botany and in the sciences and in drawing. So to get a better sense of the kind of social history of instruction and the implicit politics within those.
Love it. Seriously, go ahead. Sorry.
It's fun. You know, at this point, it connects back to like a couple of threads that I left, like my very first year of graduate school that I couldn't figure out a way to tie up. And they were creating all these other things. Like I was really interested in almanacs and Benjamin Smith Barton, who's kind of the first American botanist in many ways. And now I see how they all come together, which is like the fun of working on something for so long. Yeah. So
yeah. And also you're talking about research that, first of all, you know, how do you come, students think, how do I come across a topic or how do I develop a topic? Well, look at how you developed your topic, right? almost by accident in some ways, a lot of ways. And then what if you hadn't come across those drawings? And then, the twists and turns along the way, including as you're turning it into a book, those are all students who may be listening, current or prospective, all important lessons.
Yeah. The dance of like following the archives and then also pushing them and creating new ones, that sort of element too of the push and pull of a topic and having that's to create an archive part. Where there isn't one. Yeah,
that's amazing. It's really exciting, really, really interesting work. So then the other piece of your work I'd like to ask you about is the and again, some of this is just you're good at titles. So these titles jump out at me. And I've been to the Tenement Museum a couple of times in New York City, including before it was open to the public because an alum who's now a history teacher out in the Fieldston School in the Bronx. Anyway, she was working there at the time. In any case, but this piece you've been working on and is it forthcoming or you hope it will be forthcoming?
We submitted to the reviewers I feel like the beginning of the semester. I can't remember some of that. So August or September 1st, something like that. Yeah.
It's going to be published. I feel it. Stewarding a Fragmented Landscape, Potted Plants in Tenement Housing. All right. You got me right there. Potted Plants. What is that about?
People love a potted plant. Yeah. So this is about, so this was supposed to be like a tiny palate cleanser project, which is like, I should know better by now. But
yeah, yeah.
As soon as I started to put together the abstract and the draft, and workshopped it with the Atlantic workshop at the U, and then they were like, this is like seven different chapters. I'm like, no, it's just supposed to be a 30-minute talk. So I got interested in... So landscaping, garden and landscape studies is sort of a subfield. It's its own robust field that I'm lucky to be part of through my involvement with Dumbarton Oaks, who does, incredible programming around it. And so I went to a graduate workshop at Dumbarton Oaks several years ago, met incredible colleagues who, I'm still very close with. And that's a piece of it was Leanne Custer was working on... her book, which I should have had it in front of me. I don't have the title, but about like urban air modernism. And she writes about different painters working in New York. And she did an analysis of a John Sloan painting.
Oh, God, I love John Sloan.
The title that I can't remember. And it is of a rear tenement and a person doing some laundry, it appears. And there's a potted plant in a window.
Oh, wow.
So this was just one of those moments where we started talking about it as a group. It wasn't a big piece of the bigger things that she was getting at, but it was a fun detail because, I was writing more specifically about plants like that.
Yeah.
So then I wanted like a refresher and that had stuck in my head for a few years. And then I thought, well, maybe this is a chance to get back to that. And, I'm always curious about how we can leverage, theory or just like fresh methodologies to be more inclusive in our histories. So there's lots of great histories about tenements at this point. Absolutely. Yep, food historians and architectural historians, like, yes. So in keeping with that sort of momentum, I thought, what would a landscape history of the tenements look like? And how can we, think about, buildings as landscape and everything from the brick, you know, baking the brick from the bottom of the Hudson River that then became the tenements, and the same sort of sediment being roasted into, you know, terracotta planters and then put on the stoop. So the sort of materiality of that, of the landscape becoming, you know, a building and these sorts
of
things.
That is, again, so cool. So, I mean, God, yeah. You know, I love John Sloan. I've taught John Sloan, but as a historian, right? Here's some stuff to illustrate what I'm talking about, not looking at the images as text themselves. Anyway, so more than one potted plant you found in images, or is that the...
Yeah, so, right. And so a big piece of it just became, because as you know, I think, as I've said, I'm less interested in painting in general.
Yeah,
as a teenager. But so photographs, I was looking especially at municipal photos and photos from the Sanitary Commission and seeing what sort of visual archive and how we can read those, you know, both formally and socially as evidence and as documents. So kind of reading this fresh archive and then reading images that are well known, like the Jacob Riis, you know, photographs, and Lewis Hine, and just as they do in factories, Hine and Riis have very different approaches to tenements as well. So, so it was a deeper analysis of where we see paper flowers, potted plants, floral decor, what types of plants, how we can understand through literature, through paleobotany, through excavations done at Five Points, what exactly became, you know, what plants they were growing and maybe why. And
Five Points
and giving a more, giving a sense of sort of stewardship of the land, even in these fragments.
It's just great. It's fabulous. I love it. Seriously. It's so cool. First of all, because I love cities. And I'm, you know, I guess technically a labor historian, sort of. Anyway. But is that interesting. And then just thinking about, you know, if you say tenement, right, to people, then what comes to mind, right? Dreary, drab, awful, crowded, you know, smelly, I guess. But yeah, there's a potted plant, or there are plants. That is just so cool. I love it.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
Yeah, there's agency. There's curated domestic space.
There's beauty, right? They're creating. Yeah, I mean, you know, what are they? And then what's hanging on the walls, right? What are they? I love that stuff too. And any photo from the past, if there's, I love looking at what do people have, or paintings too, or what's there on the wall. That's cool. Just fantastic. Thank you. I wondered, you know, what that was about, and I now know. So the other thing you're interested in that I mentioned in the introduction, this seems like a pretty big piece of your research or interest, is the quote unquote global histories of color. How did you, and not just, I mean, in a specific time period, pre and early modern world, and you know, that Atlantic world, as we now call it, at least some scholars call it. How'd you get into that? Want to tell us a little bit about how you got into it and what it's about, what your research is about there?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and that research is really is pedagogical. That has always just been about, you know, teaching and learning and sort of facilitating connection and thinking differently. So, although I suppose I do have all that work I did on Indigo, which is related, but
I saw that. Yeah. Think of you, and I'm always thinking of you now, every time I say the word Indigo in class, talking about slavery. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I guess one of the conversations that sparked the idea of the workshop, well, I was in early modern studies. I mean, that was one of my major fields in my doctorate. So I tried to get as much range as I could, especially as an Americanist. So landscape history, you know, Americanist history, history of enslavement, and early modern studies are sort of, so that, so we, you know, there's some wonderful faculty there, and we got a lot of, just had fun digging into that Atlantic approach to history, which is also sort of interdisciplinary.
Yes, very much so. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, early, like, I'm trying to remember, I feel like we were, even though we didn't have like formal syllabus making necessarily, like we were always encouraged to be thinking about how, you know, how we would innovate the survey and things of that sort. You know, I think the future of art history was coming to focus, and the need to have range, and the need to sort of switch up and decenter whiteness in European history to the extent that we can, as people trained in that tradition.
Yeah.
You know, we could at least try to do something else with the way that the surveys are structured. So So that's a piece of it. Another piece of it was wanting to do kind of hands-on stuff with folks in my cohort and the history of science cohort at the University of Minnesota. So getting into that materiality is you know, another really important way of connecting with history. And there's Art Techne is a group based in the Netherlands. And I did a class that had like an exchange in Utrecht. So we went there to, you know, to connect with these incredible researchers at the Rijksmuseum who are doing what's called technical art history. So it's in some ways like combining conservation science with visual material culture and looking deeply at recreating the methods of paint making or of lost wax sculpture. There's a big project on Janmetser because those are so, you know, complicated. So that was part of it, I guess I would say, is just learning from these technical art historians and getting into these little niches of fun research. Hands-on, right?
Yeah, I was just taking the words out of my mouth. I was just going to say, it sounds like fun and it's hands-on. And I assume you're working that into your own teaching, I imagine, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think especially because I'm teaching, you know, out of my element in the ancient realm, obviously I don't have to do a ton of that because we have an incredible, Department of Greek Studies and Roman Studies. Yep. Mm-hmm. But we still do need to get some of that, you know, deep history. And I think having a material, even if it's an idea of a material, even if we don't have rocks of all of these things to touch, like, I think it helps students connect with this like extremely long history of the past. So like ochre, for example, that we can sort of talk about, you know, rocks and cave painting and all these different methods of extraction, right? Then we get to mineral pigments and we can talk about valuation of these things and lapis and gold, right? So they get to all those like big questions about rethinking what matters, rethinking what has value, and trying to create a networked global history instead of something that is centered around this one idea. Instead, you have these objects and these materials that are incredibly mobile and they have multiple sites of origin. So I think it's a nice tangible way to try to.
Yeah, that's cool. Does part of the, I don't know if this phrase is used, transnational turn in history. That is all awesome. The other thing is like everything has a history, right? That's the other thing that students mm-hmm. You just totally. Said, I mean, color has a history. Then Indigo, you know, you reminded me, I'm just thinking of what was the movie? Daughters of the Dust. Did you ever see that movie? Julie Dash. It's an incredible movie. And in there, might take on the place in the Sea Islands, but I think I have the right move. The indigo, the color, it's this beautiful blue dye. And I always try to get my students to think about this. Like, you know, we think of, you're talking about Atlantic slavery, you're talking about sugar and, you know, and then indigo, and indigo's beautiful. I mean, it makes this beautiful color, right? And textiles. And then who doesn't like sugar? But then the horrors that go along with both of those, right, in that Atlantic mm-hmm. world because of enslavement. Let me ask you just quickly, what so I was quoting you, I think, when I in the intro, enslavement in the Atlantic world and its tethers to visual culture and ways of making. Can you, I think those are your words or someone's words about you or your words. What does that mean? I'm curious, can you unpack that a little bit for us, what that's about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big, big question for a few words. But I think, like, if we look at, you know, let's say a 17th century still life from Spain, we think, oh, that's a nice picture. And all those oranges, like, look at how well those are painted. And the peel is just hanging off of the orange and like this beautiful shell. What is that? Abalone? Like, you know, if I'm trying to just pretend paint a picture, but we think of these as like, maybe Spain's not a good example, but like a Renaissance painting. And then when you actually think about what that is about, right, which is often a show of wealth. Well, what would a show of wealth be at that point in time? Well, it would be a show that you had, you know, people who went to other places for you and got that thing and brought it back. Right. Because those things aren't all just growing and thriving in.
Right. You don't go down to the local convenience store or whatever. Yeah, exactly. Or growing there. Yeah.
Right. So I think that tether for me, just in terms of teaching, is about helping people ask those questions of why that thing is there or how that thing was done and who all was involved in creating that one thing, even if it's a brushstroke of ultramarine, right?
Yeah.
That there were only, you know, 2 to 3 places that ultramarine, which comes from lapis, even existed at that point in time. So what did it take for that to get to this painter's palette, right? So that sort of element of trying to weave that glitch thinking into our everyday so that we're continually asking both about history and about our present of how something comes to be in front of us, especially things that are, you know, made by people with their
hands. I mean, yeah, you know, ask me what am I wearing and where is it made? I do that with the students. Who know, right? I don't know. But mm-hmm. yeah, to think about, that's all fantastic. And again, yeah, it's just so cool. Like okay, you're looking at this painting or an object, but what lies behind it, including a whole labor system, you know, or plantation system. I mean, it's really, it's fantastic.
Or like add in mahogany or different types of wood or with the burlap, you know, who wove the, you know, it's endless.
All very cool. And so clearly you're interested in material objects and material culture. That relates to my next question, which is about this audits project at Gustavus. Is that ongoing?
We just started it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So we've just launched this objects audit, strategic assessment of collections, I think maybe by the technical name. And Adriana and Jeff in the archives have been extremely generous working with me and a few students who are starting to investigate a collection of, you know, 3D objects. A lot of them are artwork. Some of them are artifacts. It depends what they are. And they're from all over the world. A lot of them are also Native American made. So so we've been curious about what those are, why they're here, and how we can best interpret, display, and preserve them or repatriate and whatever else may need to happen, right? Okay. So we're just looking closely at what we have. And that helps us fill out narratives about the, you know, the role of Lutheran missionaries in bringing these things here. In many cases, that's how they got here. And, you know, it's a great opportunity for that hands-on learning again. So students are getting the research end of things. They're getting to write up these finding aids and sort of web pages about these different types of objects so that we can better understand them. And and then hopefully we can, you know, do more knowing what we have to either teach with them or like I said, you know, put together exhibitions or whatever else.
Yeah.
So it's an important step.
Is it a large percentage of them from indigenous peoples, would you say? It sounds like a significant portion.
Yes, I would say a significant portion. We haven't done all of the math yet, and there's more research to be done because some things, you know, the folks in the archives did the best they could with documentation from the 50s, from the 80s to put everything, all the info that they had into the database. But some of them maybe need to be recategorized. There's some questions, especially about the baskets in the collection of whether those came from East Africa or whether those are from the American Southwest. So
that's amazing.
Pretty important questions have the answers to.
Yeah, no kidding. And Gustavus is doing, you know, like a lot of schools, right? And some of this is post-George Floyd, not all, but, you know, this indigenous reconciliation initiatives and efforts, part of a larger project. By the way, so is this part of the National Endowment for the Humanities grant we got? Is it funding this or is it separate?
That is helping fund it. Yes. But it came out of, just a innovation request from me and the department and investigating what sort of challenge seminars we're going to put together.
So teaching innovation,
the critical issues in art class that I teach and the work that I'm, you know, doing on the Indigenous, relations, the president's Indigenous Relations Council's part of that. So it was a perfect time in some ways, but just in terms of how long I've been here, found out they were there and then immediately needed to do something about them.
Yeah. Wow.
It was more
that's amazing. And so we were chatting, or maybe I think it was before we started recording, but you start in 2020, and COVID is on. So, how did that go? I mean, you were teaching online like we all were. I don't know how was it for you? I'm asking terrible. The historical record. It was terrible. Yeah.
What were you teaching?
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it was everything, you know. I had gotten a Smithsonian fellowship as well. And I had the permission to, you know, sign and start the following year. And then I had to just give all that up because everything was so precarious.
I saw. Yeah.
So it was an intense time, for sure. And to have to pivot, you know, I had done so many like worksheets and close looking sometimes at printouts so that we're not always looking at the screen and, you know, lots of ways about doing collaborative learning that I had to quickly transfer to the internet, which luckily, you know, we have the Google Suite and there's a lot of cool tools in there that worked well for that. But yeah, it was definitely different. It's
proverbial baptism by fire. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Do you think what?
No, it was wild. I mean, it's funny now that, you know, I am back in person. I'm still not like lecturing in the way that I might've if I had a different way of starting, if that makes sense.
It does make sense.
Yeah.
Had you taught much before? I mean, as a graduate student, like teaching fellow or that sort of thing, or how much teaching?
As a graduate student? Yeah. But I didn't have a ton as instructor of record.
Okay. I had a little bit, but still coming, if I had to do that my first year, and I know there were others as well, not just you, but still, wow. Thank you for getting through that. it's like, and maybe we never have to do it again. So I actually wanted to ask you about the critical issues in art. And I know this could be a whole podcast in itself, but kind of in a nutshell, what are the critical issues? I mean, what do you look at there in that course?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, part of what we do is we look at, like, what are the critical issues in the world right now or in your city or in your town or at Gustavus right now? And it turns out all of them are also related to the arts, right? Whether there's a solution there, whether people are thinking creatively about how to address that, getting examples of, you know, social practice art or activist art that are navigating those things. But then there's other things like climate change, right? That collection protection, floods, weather events, war, all of those things, you know, a conflict, they have a huge effect on cultural heritage or, I mean, that's not,
yes,
right, right? We're getting away from word heritage, no, but yeah.
Yeah.
So collection. So all of those things matter too, to how we understand, you know, our history through these visual and material items. And then other things like just today in critical issues, we talked about the Sacklers and the money, you know, the Sackler wing at the Met and sort of how museums are navigating funding as far as, you know, getting money through the.
They gave so much money to the Met and other for the arts. Yeah. That is also cool. I mean, this is a theme in your work and in your teaching, which I think is hugely important, which is art and, I mean, I'm, you know, simplifying, oversimplifying, art and politics, right? And the political implications of art, the artistic implications of politics or for politics. I think that's just so important, so interesting. The other thing is that I wanted to, ask you about kind of related to this, I guess, is, and you're already answering it in talking about critical issues, but to make a case for, I mean, the arts and also art history. I mean, why bother? Why are they important? Why should someone study them or maybe even major in them at a place like Gustavus?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, question of the ages, right? I think it's important to imagine as I'm, you know, driving down the highway on the way home that everything I'm encountering was a design decision, right? That every aspect of where that road is, the pitch of the, you know, the pitch, the angle, the content of the concrete, right? The material makeup of the paint lines, like every bit of our built world, and even some of our unbuilt world is, you know, is affected by these visual and design decisions that we make. And I think when we're talking about things like systemic racism, that it's easy to forget that system is in that word, and system, you know, or structural racism, right? Those are designed structures and systems are created. They're things that have visual components as well as, you know, sometimes numerical and other things. But I think that's a big piece of it for me, is just helping helping sort of create inquiry structures and ways of questioning that help us dig into those big questions.
Because, yeah, you're just you're raising. I mean, I'm maybe a closet urban historian too. I love urban history. I don't keep up with it the way. But anyway, I love that. We once took students. Where are we? Oh, maybe in London or I can't remember. But you just look. Use your eyes. Look down. Look up. Look everywhere and listen as we move around the city. And I like that idea of design choices, which you could apply to that potted plant too, right? I mean, that's a design choice by right, or if I decide where to put my, I mean, those are, I think that's right. All really, really interesting and important.
Yeah, that there's visual solutions and there's visual complicity in a lot of these different issues, and that piece of it is really important. Is that it is one more critical layer of how we can, you know, make the world better. There's a student in critical issues working on how terrible, you know, medicine and medical care can be for folks of color. And so one of the things we've been looking at, or she's been looking at, is the role that medical illustration plays in that, and just how radical it has been. Like recently, an illustrator went viral for making, you know, illustrations of a person about to give birth. But the baby, the fetus inside there is black. And the body is black. So even in this cross section, right? So these questions again about like everything terrible that's happening in the world. Mm-hmm. If we look at why, some of that is a visual problem, right? That textbooks and the way that we teach medicine is in this particular way. But then it's also part of it's part of the creative. I keep saying
it's part of the solution.
There's better words for that.
Well, I was just going to say, is it your phrase or where? I love that phrase, which I had not heard before, visual complicity. I'll be citing you because I'll be using that. That's a really great phrase, I think. Yeah, just the realization of how important visuals, the visual is. I mean, this institute on this visual culture, the Civil War, is mind-boggling how important. And it was everywhere. I mean, on canteens, everywhere, on postage stamps, on sheet music, and the messages being communicated, you know, whether about the Union or about slavery, against slavery, for slavery. It was just absolutely everywhere. And that's without TV and, you know, all the other ways we have of being bombarded by images today. It just sounds great. I could talk forever about all this stuff with you. So as we wind down here, I want to ask you about your drawings. So what are they like, if you don't mind talking about those? What kinds of drawings?
Sure, yeah. Like? I mean, I haven't done a ton recently, although I did get to get back into some botanical drawing because I did a rare book school course over the summer. And we were mostly learning about, you know, the history of botanical illustration. And but they brought course, in a
was that a course you taught or you were taking
no,
it?
No, I took it. Rare Book School is have you been to any of their courses? I think
no.
Abe in the library did too. It's run now out of University of Virginia. It used to be geared mostly towards rare book librarians, but has expanded now to anybody who studies books or intellectual culture. So
brought in a botanical artist.
Right. To get some of that background, since we're looking at the history of every representation of, you know, botany that this library has, what does it take to do that, you know, today even, and what are the processes? So that's been kind of neat to get back into, but mostly pencil, my sort of previous drawings, mostly pencil, abstract, kind of like, you know, actually there's some of them up on my wall in my office that I can see right now.
Oh, send me, so, if you don't mind, send me some photos.
Sure, yeah. So sort of organic shapes and thinking about the relationship between bodies and landscape. And
that's so cool. Wow.
Yeah, so traces of people, yeah.
Are you, have you done an exhibit on campus or will you be or?
Oh, no. That's for my esteemed colleagues here in the department who make proper art. But we do lots of drawing in classes because drawing is a way of thinking. It's not for exhibit sake, you know, it's for processing, I think.
I love that phrase too. Drawing is a way of thinking. I'm just, that may be the title of this episode. We'll see. That's a great phrase.
My students just peer reviewed each other's papers, their ekphrastic description. And they had to draw the artwork just based on their colleagues' words.
Wow.
Just their description of it.
Excellent. Oh, wow. We're all thrilled that you're, I know you and I chatted for our colleague, Carlos, his book, A Little Party, that was another colleague had for him. That's where you and I first met, if I remember correctly. But yeah, mm-hmm. and learned a little bit about you then, but this has been so much fun to learn a lot more. So thank you so much. Good luck with the rest of the semester. Don't do too much. Learn to say no as a faculty member. Right? Don't forget. And please, honestly, send me some, if you don't mind, at some point and get together. And definitely I will be asking you to come into the challenge seminar this spring, which I've not taught before. So
awesome. I look forward to that. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Colleen, it's been a pleasure. We're glad you're at Gustavus, and take good care. You see you on campus.
I appreciate it. Take care. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.